ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It is my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud once again will be taking us down the road to talk about all of the battles inside the ring and outside of the ring. Today, once again, we're going to talk about the Atlanta Wrestling Wars, one of the most famous, if not the most famous, promotional battles in wrestling history. But without any further ado, our host, the man of the hour, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. And Ron, the reaction we've received to part one and part two of the Atlanta Wars, I think, has taken you by surprise. It's taken me by surprise. I knew people would like it, but people have really loved it so far.
Yeah, it's just been amazing. It's one of those things that you just don't realize how. And I'll be honest with you, Brian, you suggested this for me because it's in the time frame that we're working in. And I didn't really hadn't done a whole lot of research on it. And I think what I found in research is just really it's like a history changing program, and it's really made it something that special for me because I kind of get to clear my family's name in a way and present the Atlanta Wrestling Wars and what took place and all of the facts about it in a little different light. And it's really been that for me made this really special, and the fans have just been phenomenal. In fact, you know, I want to thank them. I'd like to thank all the fans for their interest and their tremendous comments about the Studcast and the Super Studcast episodes, and especially the Wrestling War, the Atlanta Wrestling War episodes that are about a topic that, as you say, is such an important part of professional wrestling history, this Atlanta War. And I also want to give them a special thanks to those that have provided the questions for today's program. What a great questions. It's just amazing how knowledgeable we are. And I also, while I'm talking about it, you know, I'm honored, man. I'm really honored, and I'm very pleased to have the thousands of loyal and knowledgeable wrestling fans out there around the world. And the numbers just continue to grow. And these last two episodes have just been phenomenal. The comments are phenomenal. I think, you know, and what's happened here is, you know, I've found something here that really kind of makes a big change in how everybody maybe perceives this whole wrestling war. And that to me is the highlight of all of it for me is having an opportunity here to maybe change wrestling history a little bit.
You certainly have, and you've done a lot to clear the name of Lester Welch. I think his descendants, Roy Lee, should probably send you a check any day now. But we've done two episodes now on this, Ron. And even with that, there are still a lot of things we have not tackled, a lot of questions we have not answered, a lot of questions you and I both still have. So that's what makes this so interesting. We have a very knowledgeable audience, and they asked a lot of questions that you and I hadn't thought to ask or hadn't had an opportunity to ask. So we'll get some new information, I think, this week here on the show. And with that said, I'm going to kick it right off with the first question. This one was sent in by Elwood Sandridge. Ron, was Gordon Solie sent to Atlanta by your dad and Eddie Graham during the Atlanta War? I remember Gordon asking you if he can call you the Georgia Stud. This is a great question, Ron. We talked about so many of the participants in the Atlanta Wrestling War. One name we did not mention was Gordon Solie.
Yes, and you know, I'm a little bit, and you're probably going to be very helpful in this. With Gordon, I'm not sure exactly where Gordon got involved. Because I wasn't in Atlanta at that time frame. I did come in and I did some special matches and as part of the war, and I made one trip in to try to talk Ann out of doing what she was about to do in the very early stages of the war. And I don't really remember where Gordon came into the picture. I remember wrestling in the early 80s on the Superstation. And I know then at that point Gordon was there. But do you have knowledge of the actual time frame in which Gordon had arrived there?
Yeah, shortly after everything transpired in 72, in late 72, they needed a commentator. We talked about all the wrestlers left, the referees left, the booker left. So did the commentator, Ed Caprell, and I'll ask you about him in a moment. So Atlanta Wrestling on TV, at least the NWA office, did not have a commentator. Georgia and Florida, very close together. We mentioned how Eddie was involved in a lot of the things going on behind the scenes. Eddie is partners with your father. They have maybe the best commentator in all of wrestling, Gordon Solie. They send him up there. It's an easy flight. It's an easy fix. And during this period of time, they tried a lot of things. Someone who you would later work a lot with, and you've given a lot of credit to, Les Thatcher, made his debut as a commentator in Atlanta during the war. They brought him down and had him as Gordon Solie's co-commentator. For a while, it was Gordon and Les Thatcher. So they tried a lot of things, and it all comes back to they needed to replace Ed Caprell. So let me ask you two things, Ron. Any thoughts on what I just said about Gordon and everything happening? And secondly, Ed Caprell, how important was he to Atlanta Wrestling when you were there?
Well, let's start with that one. Ed Caprell was the man, and he was there in 1964 when we came to Atlanta. He was the commentator. He was the man on the program. And those guys are critical to wrestling shows. It's amazing. It's not just about the wrestlers. The commentator can make or break your program. He's that important to you. And obviously, they made this change. They're on Turner's channel at this point, and they've got a problem in which they lose Caprell. Caprell goes, he goes to Ann's program. I'm sure he does, correct? Am I correct about that?
Yeah, he goes with Ann.
Yeah, he goes with Ann along with most everybody else. And they need a commentator. And gosh almighty, there's not much better than Gordon Solie. In my opinion, he was maybe the best of all commentators. I just loved working with Gordon. And then when they brought Les in as a partner for him, Les is a real young guy at this point, and he has great ideas about television. I don't know if he gets to implement them a lot with Turner, because he's the second man on that in the seat there. Gordon's sitting in the seat in front of him, obviously, and Gordon is a man. But when I get the opportunity to work with Les, and Les gets the opportunity to take over my wrestling program in Knoxville in 1974, we really innovate. We come up with things that have never been done in studio wrestling before. And a lot of those ideas, I'm going to give credit to Les, because they were his ideas. He wanted to do this. He wanted to try instant replays. He wanted to do split screens. He wanted to do personality profiles. He had several different ideas. So that was a great program, obviously. And you've got, when following that program, Lester's show with Gordon Solie and Les Thatcher, you've got Ed Caprell, who's the face of wrestling. So, you know, Lester had such a disadvantage at this point in the war, because he's got a brand new commentator. And wrestling's really different at this point, too. You don't get to see a lot of Gordon Solie if you're in Atlanta. I don't think those people had a lot of opportunity to see Gordon. So they've got two new commentators all of a sudden. Caprell's gone. He's on the show after that show. Every hour that Lester's on, that show closes out, and Ann's All-Star comes on right afterward, and there's their guy. And not only is it there's their guy, there's their wrestlers, all the guys they're familiar with, all the angles, all the things that's going on just continue on her program and the hour following Lester. That is a really, really tough situation for Lester to be involved with. And, you know, you need those two guys. Gordon sitting there and Les Thatcher sitting there. And I don't think it would take many weeks for people to realize that, wow, these guys are good. And Gordon is just, he's off the charts good, in my opinion. And I've worked with him now at this point for almost my entire career. For the 2 years that I've been in wrestling, I'm with Gordon on his TV every week down there in Florida. And it was a great thing to happen for Lester that they were willing to send him up there. And I tell you what, having spent a lot of time with Gordon, it was a fabulous thing for Gordon. And Gordon realized it, and he was very appreciative of the fact he had the opportunity to work that TV in Atlanta.
It is pretty crazy to think that there's a world where Gordon would have never been on Atlanta TV, where it would have been Ed Caprell hosting Georgia Wrestling on Turner Television if nothing had happened.
Yes. And, you know, doesn't that make a huge difference? I'm sure the fans sitting out there listening to the program right now are going, wow, never thought of it about that way. But Gordon really, he puts his style and the way he presents things just makes him kind of unique in commentators around wrestling. And I've been all over the world and seen a lot of them and worked with a lot of great commentators. But Gordon is just right there at the top. And it just makes that show, it makes it, period. You know, and then when they're going to start getting all the different types of talent and everything else, that product is going to start to shine a lot more than the hour following. But that's not the case early on in the war here. They've got to make ground. They got to make up ground here because they're really starting at a big disadvantage, and people don't know Gordon and they don't know much out of the wrestlers, and there's a lot of incoming talent there. And Gordon, I think, makes a tremendous difference in that. Being there makes a fabulous, fabulous difference for them and gives them an opportunity to get off the ground quick.
Ron, this next question was sent in on the Mothership Facebook group, which is a Facebook group for listeners of the 605 Super Podcast. And this question is from Paul Stewart. If Buddy Fuller won the battle over TBS TV, and I assume he means getting the TV on TBS, working with Ted Turner. If Buddy Fuller won the battle over TBS TV, why did he swap with Lester Welch for a less valued territory? And if Roy Welch controlled most of the South, why didn't he control Atlanta? Interesting questions.
Oh, great question. Great question. Well, let's do the second question first here. My granddad started out in Tennessee, and he kind of built his empire, his wrestling territory empire, utilizing his family members. And he had a bunch of them. He had three brothers, and then they were all getting up in age, and they were having families, and their families were about ready to go into wrestling. And he dispersed them around the South. And it just happens that he did not get into Atlanta itself because he's in Nashville. It's a pretty good distance away from Atlanta. And he kind of goes south and he works north. So he goes into Kentucky and down south along the Gulf Coast. He spreads over into Arkansas and Missouri some. And he stows into West Virginia. But what happens, I believe, is that guys like Paul Jones, in 1944, Paul Jones goes to Atlanta. There's already a promoter there in Atlanta. And I just think Roy never got to that part of the country. What happened here way back in the 30s when territories were starting to first be formed, and that there was a lot of different guys trying to get involved, and everybody wanted to, like that Oklahoma land grab in which, you know, they give you free land, and all those thousands of people came and they brought their wagons there, and they dropped the flag and said, here you go get it, and you stake your claim. So everybody was staking their claim to different cities, and obviously want to get the larger markets and the larger cities first. So Roy had already staked his claim basically in Tennessee, and he had spread down north of there, south of there. He didn't get over. You couldn't go too big because if you did, you couldn't protect it all. You were going to have people that were going to come in on the fringes of your territory, and they were going to take towns away. So Roy tried to keep his in a certain area of the country, and Atlanta just happened to be a little beyond the reach of where he wanted to go. So I think that answers that part of the gentleman's question. And there's it was a really funny time frame in there. Now, Dad's there, and the value of the territory, that's a great point, because Dad, at this point, he swaps everything. Lester and him, they don't just swap territories, they swap lives. So everything is swapped, and Lester has a smaller piece even of Florida than what Dad owns of Atlanta. But Florida is a tremendous territory, too. I don't know that people realize that Florida has got more major cities. When you look at the Atlanta territory and what you actually owned, if you owned a portion of that territory, you owned Atlanta, you owned Columbus, and you owned Savannah.
I'm
sorry, you don't own Columbus, you own Augusta. So you got Atlanta, you got Augusta, and you have Savannah. You have three pretty major markets, Atlanta obviously being the hoss. But when you look at Florida, you got Jacksonville, you got Miami, you got Tampa, you've got West Palm Beach, you've got Tallahassee. It's just a bigger state, and it's got more major markets. So the trade level, the amount of stock owned by each, by Dad and by Lester, is Dad owns almost 50%, 45% or so of Atlanta, and he's going to pick up Lester's probably 15, maybe 20% of Florida. Doesn't seem like it's a fair deal, but if you took the population of those two areas and compared them, you'd see that probably that's not a real bad deal. It's a great question, though. I mean, obviously, when you look at it at first, you go, wow, especially what's about to happen here. And Dad he knew what Ted's idea was and what Ted wanted to do. He knows that Ted's going to blow this thing up and that it's going to explode into being something bigger than the television station ever has been. And that was where the real value comes in Atlanta. Now, when he leaves there, that value has not happened yet. When this war starts, Atlanta, that television station is not TBS yet. It has not evolved into what it's about to evolve into. So if it had been in that situation and this had happened later, I don't think Dad would have made that trade. When he saw that this is going to be a nationally televised station, it's going to eventually be worldwide because of the satellite. He would have probably been stupid to make it then, but you know, life is strange and wrestling business is strange. And I think he did it because he just couldn't get along with Ray. And I think he really believed that Lester, because Lester had he was more laid back and low key, that Lester had a better opportunity and a better chance of being a good partner with Ray.
How did Lester get along with Eddie Graham?
Fabulous. Lester got along great with everybody. Lester was just a different type of person that just, he very pleasant guy, and people liked him. Dad just figured that, you know, hell, everybody likes Lester. Even Ray would like Lester. You know, I think he probably believed even Ray would like Lester. And then we've talked about the problem with the shoot where Ray kind of sets Dad up for a shoot. And, it's hard to, after that happens, that's a partnership breaking deal there. You know, it's, you know, you got to trust your partner, and he had very little trust for him, I think, after that.
Our next question, Ron, also from the mothership, is from Sean Delaney. In your opinion, how deep in the planning with Ray and Ann Gunkel was Tom Renesto? Might he have been the key in getting the bulk of the Atlanta talent to side with All South? Of course, he's referring to the Booker, a member of the Assassins, Tom Renesto, although he says how deep in the planning with Ray and Ann. Before you answer this, Ron, do we know, did Ann have anything to do with any of this before Ray died?
I don't think so. I really don't believe that she does. I think now she comes to the matches all the time. When I was there as a I was in high school in this time frame, and I actually sold tickets, ringside tickets, on Friday nights in Atlanta, and she sold ringside tickets in the same booth that I sold out of. And we were pretty close, but she, beyond selling tickets, she did not go to the office. She wasn't part of the business. She wasn't highly involved. I think now, but I do believe that I don't think Ernesto is a critical character in this, but he is a very important part of this. If Ray's plans are as I have, I think they went down, then he needs Ernesto, because Ernesto is the booker. And for fans out there that don't know the strength and the power and how important the booker is, he's the guy that decides who the talent is going to be. He's the guy that's responsible for bringing in the right guys and to use them in the right way and to get them over. And then for them to be able to start drawing money and make him successful, the guy's successful, and the promoter, the guy that's paying the booker, successful. And Ernesto does a great job. He's been here in Atlanta for a long period of time prior to this war beginning. And if Ray wants to make this move, and I believe that's what happens here, he needs Ernesto. He needs Tom. And Tom is a critical figure in all this. And obviously, Tom is going to get him as many of those guys as he can, and manages to get almost all of them. So Tom obviously does a great job in convincing these guys this is what we need to do. This is going to be a great thing. We're all going to benefit from it.
Did you ever encounter Tom Ernesto after this period of time?
Never saw Tom after 1970. I wrestled there when I started, and I started in May of 1970, and I wrestled there until November of 70 when I went to Florida. And after I left to go to Florida, I don't think I ever saw Tom again. I didn't go back at all until the war. Just about until the war was starting was the first time that I was ever back booked in Atlanta again after I left and went to Florida.
Ron, our next question was sent in by Paul Shivers. What would have happened if Ann Gunkel had won the War of Atlanta? How would that have changed the landscape of Atlanta wrestling?
Oh, what a great question there, too. Well, I think there would have been a lot of changes. One thing is the NWA would have not, that wouldn't have been an NWA market. I don't think, because of the way things went down, the NWA recognized Lester as being, Lester continued to have ownership with Paul. And I think people within the NWA had knew who was the perpetrator here and who would pull this off. And they supported Lester because of that. I think if Ann had won the war, she would have probably ended up doing what some other territories did. Jerry Jarrett he used to use Vern's champion, the AWA champion. So there were territories around the country and around the world that weren't a part of the NWA. And if they wanted to have a champion, some had their own champion. Obviously, you got WWF up there in New York, and they're using their own champion and their own people. So, you know, you would create your own darn world champion, or you would affiliate yourself with somebody else. If you couldn't get into the NWA, and there was a lot of people trying to get in the NWA, a lot of owners of territories that wanted, that made bids to become part of the NWA and then got turned down. And when they did, they end up having to go a different direction. I think that's what would have happened. If she had won the war, whoever is going to win the war is probably going to be successful, the most successful. And at that point, she's in a position where she's not a part of the NWA. She starts looking somewhere else for her world champion, somebody to represent her, their company as a world champion. Or, you know, if she's there when this TBS explodes and becomes a monster deal, wow, she's in a position to do what Vince did. She's in position to take it all if she wanted to. She probably could have just about jumped in there, assembled a tremendous crew, And because her exposure was all over the country and all over the world, she had some exposure all over the world, it would have been a totally different animal. There could have been no Vince, and there might be Ann Gunkel's son operating the Empire Vince operates.
If Ann Gunkel had won the War of Atlanta, let's say she won it conclusively, and a year later, she contacts St. Louis, she calls Sam Mushnick's office, and she says, it's been a while, we have won Atlanta, we're the only ones promoting in Atlanta, we own Georgia now, we'd like to join the NWA. Do you think the NWA would have accepted her?
Well, that's questionable. And, you know, I think obviously she would have done that. She'd have been stupid not to make a play to get to the NWA if she could. But I tell you, it was a pretty nasty war, and they supported Lester with such venom and such they really got behind him. And if she had beat them, I don't know how they would have handled that. Sometimes pride is more effective for you than just brains. You know, you let that pride drag you down when you know that would have been ideal for the NWA in that situation. Gosh, I could foresee if that had been me as a young guy and you get into that position and you get the NWA's backing. You'd go to the NWA Jim did a little bit of this. Barnett does a little bit of this when he gets involved there. He kind of highlights the NWA. He pushes the NWA. He doesn't jump on everybody's markets. He goes to a few markets in which they aren't operating very much, but you could have really made a fabulous business out of it. I think Vince's business would have been different if Vince had just took that exposure, that national exposure, and not took it for himself entirely, but made it benefit everybody. And if that would have been the case, and you get the right person in there in Atlanta, you've got that TBS, and you're willing to work with the NWA and talk to Sam and convince him and several other and top individuals in the NWA that, look, I'm not here to fight you. I'm here to build you. I want to make you stronger. I think that would have been a phenomenal thing to happen.
Ron, our next question was sent in from the Mothership Facebook group and Andrew Betts. Ron, why did the NWA side with Lester and not Ann?
Well, I think it's because they were convinced that, and I think what I've said here in this in both these episodes is I think they realized that Ann and Ray were planning this, that, you know, all of a sudden you got two partners here and one of them ends up with everything. The other one ends up with nothing, basically. He's just sitting there and. You know, and as I tried to explain, this stuff doesn't happen overnight. If you're trying to steal a territory and you're trying to sneak around and get the talent to all come to you, there's a lot of time takes place here and a lot of coordination for all this to happen. And you're trying to keep it secret. All of this was kept well, tremendously quiet so that, you know, nobody knew about this until she runs on the Oglethorpe Gym on Thanksgiving night against the NWA people. And they saw it. They saw that, look, we see what's going on here. And they would have been incorrect, I believe, to support her because of the way she did it. If you're not happy with your partner and you own part of a company, you don't just try to steal the company. You try to buy the company. You try to sell your part of the company. That's not the way you do business, not in a wrestling business. Guys were usually pretty darn reputable. And what they said was there, you know, when Eddie Graham, you shook Eddie's hand, you're dealing with an honest guy and he's going to do what he says he's going to do. And he would not have handled it this way. I don't know many people that would have handled their inability to get along with a partner by just trying to take it all from them.
Our next question, Ron, was sent in by Chris Stewart. Had Jim Barnett not left Australia and returned stateside to buy out the principals in the Georgia Territory, how would it have ended? I can't see Sam Muchnick and the NWA allowing such an important territory to be decimated. It would seem like the NWA would have sent word that any wrestlers working for Gunkel's outlaw startup would be blackballed from any NWA-associated promotion.
Well, man, another great question. I think if Jim doesn't come, I think Ann was going to lose. I think Ann was destined from the very beginning to lose because of the power of the National Wrestling Alliance. So I believe if Jim had not come to America and if he had no interest in Georgia, that I believe Lester would have ended up winning this war. It was beginning to happen in 73. By 73, the Lester's office is running Omni shows, and she's still in the auditorium. They're moving away from her. They're winning the race at this point, and it's pretty obvious. I think that Lester would have won the war. He would have had the opportunity to do what he wanted to. He's on Ted's channel. Lester is the type of guy that he might have made a pitch to the NWA and said, look, I've got a great opportunity for all of us here to go national, to go worldwide, and let's all benefit from it rather than just me.
Do you think there was anyone else in wrestling at that time beyond Jim Barnett that was in that position where they can go to Atlanta, buy out whoever needed to be bought out, and take over and really unify that territory?
No, Jim Barnett is a critical figure in professional wrestling, and his history goes back way on into the late 40s, and I don't know actually how far, maybe even further back than that. It goes to before television time, And he has a respect of a lot of people. He has knowledge of everybody. He knows all the wrestlers. He knows all the promoters. He's been to Australia and run his own big business over there in Australia. And at one time he was on the Dumont Network. He ran Chicago and Indianapolis and Detroit, and they were all Jim Barnett cities. He was the monster figure way back before anybody was really. No one was as big as Barnett. And when Barnett comes, he's not only an influential figure, he's a wealthy son of a gun. He has made a tremendous amount of money in wrestling. And he's the type of guy who saved his money. And he's a critical figure in this. And I got to be really close with Jim. I worked with Jim and Dad, and Jim had a great relationship. And Rob worked as a booker for Jim. I mean, Jim Barnett, once he gets into Atlanta, he is the man. And of all people that I know in wrestling, I can't think of anybody that could have gone in there and done what he did. Now, you know, he has a way of handling people and dealing with people. Women as well as men, and I've been around Jim and with a couple of wives that I had that just went crazy for Jim Barnett. I was like, why is it you like Jim? Oh, he's just fabulous. He's just wonderful. So he's got the ability to smooth and at the same time to be dealing with Lester, and that's a great finish to that war there, actually, when you think about it. Rather than one or the other of them winning that war, they're both gone. They both get bought out. It's a pretty nice little finish. It's almost storybook.
Our next question, Ron, was sent in by Melissa Tillery. Did the fans in Atlanta know there was actually a war going on between the two promotions? Did they question why all the new talent of wrestlers were coming into the area?
Well, you know, they're watching a television station that they've started to watch that's fairly new, that it's been on for a while, and all of a sudden, after their program is, well, they get really they get really turned around backwards when the two shows come back to back. So obviously, they pretty well figure out, I think anybody could figure out, well, these are two competing companies here. And that just happens overnight, literally, on December 2nd of 72, I believe it is, that bang, all of a sudden, there's her show, and it's on right after his show. Caprell has left the original show. He's gone to someone else. You got Gordon Solie there and Les Thatcher there. It's fans are confused, and this war is not a pub. It's not dealt with in the public. It's not like the promoters are going down and talking to the newspapers, and there's articles about what's going on here. It's kind of done behind the scenes, and what's great about this war is, and there's nothing great about a wrestling war, but what is unusual about this war is they're both doing good business because they don't try to destroy each other. They don't make a big to-do about, hey, she stole my business, and this has happened, and that's happened. They just operate their territories and their businesses in competition with one another, but they do not really fight like the Knoxville War that we will talk about sometime in the future, in which the actual one group wants to try to handle business in a way it shouldn't be handled, and when that goes in that direction, it kills the business. And this war didn't kill the wrestling business in Atlanta. It may be, in certain ways, when you look at it, it actually built Atlanta wrestling. It made it bigger than it ever was when the war's over.
I have to think, if you're a fan in Atlanta during those years, you probably were in hog heaven.
Oh, you're looking at two televisions back to back, and you're not looking at the same. If let's say that Lester and Ann could have stayed together and they had talked Ted Turner into giving them that second hour, they would have been running with basically the same guys. They would just spread that talent out over the 2 hours. But in this case, Atlanta they're getting the finest. It's just unbelievable what happens in Atlanta. They're seeing the best that Ann's got, and that's the old group that's been there. And you've got Lester's group now that's infiltrated and just being blasted with talent from all over the country and all over the world. That is probably the greatest time frame and the greatest place to be as a wrestling fan in that 72 to 74 range in Atlanta.
Ron, this next question was sent in on the Mothership Facebook group from Dave Mornhenweg. Why did so many wrestlers move over to Ann Gunkel's promotion right away? Wouldn't they see the end game that Ron spoke to Ann about, the difficulty of starting up a promotion and competing directly against an NWA-backed entity?
Well, they did move right away. I mean, and they moved right away because there was a plan there. Someone had planned it. And I believe Ray was planning it. And when Ray died, kind of out of nowhere, unexpectedly, obviously, Ann goes on with the plan. But yeah, there's a plan there. And so that's what happens. I mean, the talent all moves over there. They've made their decision already, as we're going to work for Tom, for Ernesto, and we're going to work for Ann. And, you know, and the end game, you know, when I went to visit there and I spent a few hours talking to Ann about what's going to happen here, in my opinion, and how this is going to go down, and this is not where you want to be or where you need to be. You're not going to win this battle. I just kept trying to convince her, you'll never win this war. You're just fighting against too powerful an organization, the National Wrestling Alliance. It's just going to be impossible, I thought, for her to finish it. And that's basically what happened in the end. But obviously, that's why I think that the NWA supported Lester, is because, bam, it's obvious here. She stole your business. She tried to start her own company. She did start her own company. And she changed the name of the show. She changed everything. She became an owner of her own company. But, you know, the NWA did exactly what that organization was supposed to do, and they looked out for the members of the organization, and you couldn't beat them. There were no wrestling entity in that time frame could have beat the NWA, and if you were an a partnership or a member, you were treated just like they treated her, and it just was very, very difficult for anybody to beat that organization.
Ron, you hadn't seen Anne in a few years, but obviously you had been close with her and even Ray when you had lived there, even though your father may not have been close with Ray. They were great to you and your brother, and you've talked about that. How was this meeting set up? Did you call her up and say, hey, it's me, Ron, I haven't seen you in a few years, I'd like to talk to you about this? Did someone else do that? And what was it like? I mean, you always gotten along with her. You're there to meet her. She's at war with your family. What was it like being in the room with her? Was she as warm as she had always been? Was it awkward? What was it like?
Oh, it was very easy. It wasn't difficult for me. I hadn't seen her in 2 years. I'd left Georgia, and I was wrestling in Georgia, and Dad and Ray were partners, and Rob and I were wrestling there, and Rob went to Tennessee, and I left and went to Florida, and I come back 2 years later. I'm a different-looking guy. I've gained probably 35 pounds of muscle, and I'm not the same Ron that used to be in high school selling tickets with her in the ticket booth. And we had very nice evening. I felt comfortable with her. We were friends. We were always friends. And I didn't hold any grudge about what she was trying to do. I really felt sorry for her. I could see that she's making a horrible mistake here. And I wanted to really talk. I really wanted to talk her out of it, because I just felt like she's going to spend a lot of money that she might want to live on later, and just wasted trying to win this war. And I just couldn't convince her, but we had a nice time together. And she took me, like I said, and showed me her brand new wrestling office. And it was nice. It was beautiful. It was absolutely gorgeous. I'd never seen a wrestling office as pretty as that. You know, and I wanted to tell her, Ann, I think this is a mistake, your wrestling office. You know, because you spent a lot of money here. And with wrestling companies, fans don't see your office. You know, and
wrestlers, where was the office? Where was the office for Southeastern Wrestling?
In my house, on my dining room table. I mean, you know, there was no office. I didn't even have one. You know, I never had a wrestling office in all the companies that I ran, because fans don't see it and they don't care. They just want to see the product. They want to see the wrestlers. They want to see the wrestling show. So, you know, it wasn't important. I looked at everything that she showed me, and it was fabulous. I'm telling you, it was the most beautiful wrestling office I ever saw. But it was much better than Sam Muchnick's in St. Louis. It's not necessary. It's actually in the wrong direction. You're painting a bad picture for your wrestlers, because when they see your office, they think you're being underpaid. They go, wow, geez, look at this office. I'm only getting this payoff over here, and look how she's living. So, you know, I tried to explain that to her too, and it didn't work. I couldn't get through to her, and part of it was because she got off to a great start when they ran those first shows. She was already in business. She didn't have to go through what everybody does if you build a wrestling company from scratch, and that's basically what I did in Knoxville. When I went to the Gulf Coast, did the same thing again. It's all dead. Nobody's watching your television. She gets all the talent and the commentator and her own television, and she gets started. It takes months to get to where she was at. And when she opened the doors and sold her first ticket, it takes months to be able to get to that point. And so I could not, no matter, I don't think if I'd have spent the entire night talking to her about it, I would have ever convinced her that she wasn't going to win.
How was the meeting set up?
I actually got a number from Dad and them, and it was actually to her house. And I think that's probably because Dad had Ray's number for many, many years, and he says, here's her number, and give her a call. I didn't know if it was going to call where it was going to. I didn't know it was going to be her home, to be honest. I just called the number, and there she was, and we talked a little bit, and she's like, oh, Ron, yes, please. In fact, I went to her house first before I went to the office. She says, come to my house. you know, and she gave me the address. I'd been there many, many times. And then you got to think, too, here, her husband's only been gone for 4 months or so. So she's still in a bad state of mind, and she's suffering. And it was a little bit of a hard thing for me to go and do that and to have those conversations with her. But I had tremendous sympathy for her because I cared for her. She was a nice lady, and she'd always been good to me. And I really believed that what Dad and Eddie were having me do was a good thing for her. If she sees this, she'll quit and she'll save a lot of money for herself. I think they would have bought her out. I think they would have, you know, they would have made her an offer and said, you know, don't do this. Let us just buy you out if you're unhappy. But it didn't go that way.
Do you think there was any option that would have been offered where they would have bought her out but allowed her to maintain a minority interest?
I think, you know, at that point, it's just started. You know, I go in there, I think I'm in there on the 9th of December in that year to do TV. She's only run two shows, you know. So at that point, I think they would have pretty much said, Ann, you know, you're about to make a mistake here. Let's readjust the... but then when you start readjusting her part of the business, and you gotta stop this, and you gotta do that, and I think she's looking at, I own all of this. If I can win this, I will own all of it rather than a piece of it. And that probably had a little weight. That probably carried quite a bit of weight in her thought process too. I'm 100% owner here, and I didn't have that type of deal before, so. It was a really difficult thing to try to talk someone out of something that they're pretty well convinced that you're just not telling me like it's going to be.
From the Mothership Facebook group, Tracy Warraby has a question. Ron, how much heat was there between the two companies' talent rosters?
I don't think there was any heat. I think what happens here in a wrestling war is wrestlers are independent. Oh, they're very independent. They're like cowboys back in the 1800s, and they'll go wrestle or they'll go rope cows and do whatever they need to do for anybody. They'll take the job for anybody. They have a talent, and they just want to work. They want to work, and they want to make money, and they wanted to be treated good and appreciated, but they don't. There was no animosity. I really don't believe there was animosity between the boys. Now, there's a great deal of animosity here between Lester and between Ann and the entities that used to be partners, because they're about to lose their nest egg. They're about to lose what they've invested in. And, you know, of course there's going to be, but wrestlers don't get involved normally in vendettas. The Knoxville war is going to be a little bit different. It's a totally different war than the Atlanta war, and it's kind of vendetta almost oriented. And they don't protect when do the wrestlers do. We had a little hostility in Knoxville that never happened in Atlanta, because for one thing, both sides are making money. They begin with, they're all doing well, and the wrestler doesn't care. He's looking at what am I making at the end of the week here, and I'm happy. If I'm making the right amount, I don't care who I'm working for. They're in it for the job and just to be a part of it. And if they make good money, they're going to be happy with things, and they don't have any animosity toward the guys on the other side, because they're doing the same thing I am. They're just trying to make a living, and they don't have a dog in the fight. You know, they're just there, and they happen to be the guys that are responsible for making a difference.
A similar question here, Ron. We talked about heat between the two locker rooms, between the two rosters. Kevin Endress wants to know, did you or your brother Robert harbor any ill feelings for the wrestlers who ran opposition against your uncle?
No, not really, no. No, we had, even I didn't have a lot of disdain or even dislike for Ann. I realized she thinks that she's in the right and she thinks that this is what she needs to be doing. But I never got really angry with her. And we both grew up in wrestling families, and we saw business from a wrestler's side of a business, and we saw it from a promoter's side of the business. We got to experience all those things from 12 years on up, and you just realize what it's all about. This is a war. The wrestlers aren't doing it because they want a war. They're just wrestling for the people that want to pay them, and they're going to stay with them. A lot of times, if a wrestler's not happy with his money, he'll go from one company to the other in an instant. You get somebody really over in that war, had, let's say, Wrestling 2, who just really gets over for Lester's company. If Ann had offered him a big, huge amount of money, he might have just stepped over there and wrestled for her. I mean, you just didn't get mad at other wrestlers for what they did, because you're all out there in the same business, and you were pretty much friends with just about everybody. You were stupid in wrestling to be a wrestler and not be friends with just about everybody. You didn't want to have vendettas. You didn't want to have bad feelings with guys, because you might end up 2 years later working against those guys in somebody else's territory. So you wanted to try to make things smooth and nice as long and as often as you could.
You didn't have any problems with anyone else, but once you become a promoter, would you have been at all reluctant to book anyone who had gone with Ann, or specifically to, at any point, and I know you didn't, but would you have been open to using Tom Renesto as a booker or anyone else that was involved in what happened in Atlanta? Would you have had any problems booking someone to work for you who was a part of the Atlanta War?
That's a great question too. You know, I think, when you change, when you become a booker and not just a wrestler, you're part of an office now. You're part of a company. You're not just like every other wrestler on the card. You have a different relationship with the owners of that company. And that's kind of a critical matter. And in the Knoxville War, it's Bob Roop, and he comes from Roy Shires out there in San Francisco. And it's, your booker is different than your wrestlers. He's a part of your company, and you have a different relationship with him. You talk to him a lot more, and you discuss things. And it's so it. Yes, I didn't have. I would have had hard time hiring Tom Renesto, because if he does it once, he may do it again. And if he does it to you, he may do it to somebody else. And in the case of Roop, he'd already tried it with somebody else, and he does it to me. So, you just, wrestlers know, bookers, a whole different game. Yes, you would probably be hesitant to hire them. I don't think a lot of wrestlers got blackballed because of this Atlanta War. I could be wrong. I was not in it. I wasn't there. I didn't hear everything that was going on. I was not at that point part of the National Wrestling Alliance. I didn't own my own company, so I wasn't privy to what's going on behind the scenes. I don't know the honest answer to, did some of them get blackballed and were names passed around? I think that would have been maybe unlawful. I'm not sure that would have been even legal to do that. But thank goodness I was just a wrestler at that point, and I don't have knowledge of some of the things that, once I got partners and a member of the NWA, I began to find out how that organization worked.
We have a couple more questions here, Ron. I just want to clarify something that you said for the listeners who aren't aware yet, because we're not going to really get in-depth into Knoxville just yet. But you said Bob Roop had done it to Roy Shire, and then he came to work for you. For those who don't know, Ron didn't know what Bob Roop had done in San Francisco to Roy Shire, which was one of the reasons he actually came to work for Ron, is because Ron was unaware that Roop had tried to steal the territory in San Francisco already, correct?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, if I had known that, because he's not just a regular wrestler. He's not coming in there just to wrestle for me. He's coming in there to handle my talent, to handle my people, to handle my business. And I would have never given him the opportunity. I wouldn't have trusted him at all because of his history. So, yeah, there are certain people that are critical to your company in the wrestling business, and one of those is your booker, and you really got to have a great relationship with your booker, and you want to work on that relationship continually. Some promoters and owners, they stifle their booker. They say, no, I don't want to do that. Tell me what you're going to do next week. Tell me what you're going to do next week. No, I don't want that. You can't do that. As a booker, you can't have an owner like that, because then he doesn't give you a chance. And then when business isn't good and it starts to fail, they point the finger at you and they go, you didn't get the job done. Well, you know, really, in essence, you didn't give me the chance. So, you know, yeah, I did not know what Bob Roop had done out there in San Francisco, and I would not have brought him in.
Ron, Craig Brinkley wants to know, have you reached out to Ted Turner to get his story?
Well, you and I have talked a little bit about that, Brian. I mean, that's a hard interview right there.
We're waiting for a callback, if anyone's
Yeah. I mean, Ted Turner is not, you don't just go down to the TV station and say, where's Ted's office? And I want to speak to him. You know, I mean, it didn't work that. Sometimes it works like that for a lot of people, but it doesn't work like that for somebody who's in Ted Turner's seat. And that's a really difficult deal. I would love to. I mean, oh, gosh. We'd both love to have him on here, wouldn't we, Brian?
I would just love to hear him talk about Buddy. You know, I know Buddy and him were close. I'd love to hear Ted's side of hanging out with Buddy Fuller.
Yeah, and Ted was and every time I talk to people about this, I talked to somebody the other day that was saying, Ron, Ted was just a huge wrestling fan that somebody told me this, that he used to bring different dates, different women to TV, to the television tapings. And, it was just an event for him, and wrestlers knew him, and obviously the promoters knew him, and he was just a big fan at the time. And, it would be a great interview. I mean, to hear Ted's perspective of wrestling and how he's a sharp guy, because he grasped very quickly that when I get TBS up and running and everything is doing what it needs to do, I need wrestling. He just saw that, because those years in Atlanta and the matches and those and the ratings those television stations were getting, the ones around the state that were carrying wrestling, he realized as a smart man that this is what I want to base my business on. And he didn't just take a wrestling program and throw it on at midnight on a Sunday night. He put it into a prime spot, realizing and recognizing that this is what's going to build my TBS. And this is what this one program, these two wrestling shows here, have an opportunity and the ability to make my station successful.
Ron, our final question here this week is from Todd Flynn, and you've somewhat addressed it already. Ron, which wrestling war was the nastiest, the Atlanta War or the Knoxville War?
Boy, there's no way around that. That's an easy answer. The Knoxville War was the dirtiest wrestling war that could possibly be. Things were done terribly there. Just the opposite of what happened in Atlanta. Atlanta has a 2-year wrestling war that ends up making the city an even better wrestling town. And Knoxville's 6-month, 8-month wrestling war destroyed a great market for many years. Took 5 years. No one could go in there after that war and make that draw again. I don't think anybody had any success in there. I left there and sold out to Jim Barnett and Fred Ward in 1979, went down to Pensacola to take the South End down there, my Southeastern Wrestling, and just light it up, just change it and just make it very successful. And nobody for 5 years came into that market of Knoxville that had been a fabulous market and could draw anything there because of the war and the way the wrestlers handled the war and the way the individuals on the other side didn't care about whether wrestling survives here. If we don't survive and it all caves in, we can go somewhere else and wrestle and it's no skin off our back. But it was a horrible thing that happened there. So in 1985, we got the opportunity to put a television show back into Knoxville. And we're now continental. We've evolved from Southeastern to continental, and we've got Bob Armstrong, and we've got everybody that we had when it was big time in Knoxville and things were going good. And we put our TV show in there. I left it in there 3 weeks. We went in and ran it, and we sold out the Coliseum. It's like it was the biggest homecoming. Fans went nuts. They were like, wow, they've come back, our old wrestlers. They wanted it so badly, and they just wanted to see the people that they had really loved 5 years earlier. And we went back and just blew it away with Continental. Maybe did better than when it was Southeastern 5 years earlier.
Well, with that, Ron, we're going to wrap up this week's show. But this has been tremendous, and I guess we really have to thank the fans, the listeners of the Studcast, because these questions were spectacular, and I think we may have to do more of these kind of shows where we get some listener questions about specific topics we do, Ron.
Yeah, I think these programs I really love, and gosh, we have such knowledgeable fans, and like you say, these questions have just been fantastic, and this is a great subject, you know, not just for fans, but, you know, for wrestling owners and for someone who has owned companies and dealt with this type of thing. It's just a perfect example, the Atlanta War being so different from the Knoxville War, and the results of the Atlanta War as compared to the Knoxville War. I can't hardly wait to do the Knoxville War, and I think we're probably going to get into that long before we reach it in Studcast time. We may do a super Studcast on the Knoxville War itself.
That would be spectacular. I know many listeners will be looking forward to that, of course. This week's show was populated with your questions. Those questions were submitted on Facebook. And if you want to become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook, you could do so and potentially submit questions in the future. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You could also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. We want to invite you to visit tnstud.com for every single episode of the Studcast, as well as every Super Studcast, every rest of the story, Tennessee Stud souvenirs, photos, and so much more. tnstud.com. And of course, we mentioned that the Super Studcast and the rest of the story is available at tnstud.com. It's also available at patreon.com/studcast, only $2.99. What better deal in wrestling is there than that? And especially considering what's coming up on our next Super Studcast, Ron.
Yes, I mean, this is a special guest. I mean, this guy is, in my estimation, he's one of the greatest managers of all time. Not only that, but he has transformed himself into a podcasting icon. I mean, he's just phenomenal. His ability to captivate fans, and he's just a phenomenal character. And we're going to do Jim Cornette. And wow, I can't wait. I've been lucky enough to have Jim do some things and allow me to do some stud stories on his podcast. And he has such a phenomenal audience. This guy is just, he is what podcast is all about. I mean, he is, He's just revered by people, and I love him. He's just a wonderful guy. He has the great stories, and we're going to do the next one. Number 10 is going to be done on October 9th. It's going to come out on Tuesday, October 9th, and it's going to be Jim Cornette. I can't wait, and I'm sure fans out there are going to say the same thing. There's a lot of Studcast fans, oddly enough, that probably don't listen to Jim. And not that most everybody listens to Jim, but I think a lot of the Studcast listeners are going to get their first taste of Jim Cornette and the idea of just what makes this guy so successful in the podcasting.
2 hours with Jim Cornette. That will be Super Studcast number 10 dropping on Tuesday, October 9th, 2018. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast only $2.99. But before we get there, Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we've really done the war here, the Atlanta Wrestling Wars. I think we've kind of given fans all we can. We may come back to it at some point here. And this has been a fabulous topic for us. I really, really loved it. And I've had an opportunity to clear my family's name in some respects. And this has just been a great pleasure for me. But we are going to jump on the plane, Daddy, and we're going to fly across the Pacific Ocean to the land down under, by golly. And I've been wanting to do this for a long, long time. We're going to be there for a while, but I'm not going to just talk about wrestling when we get to Australia. That country is just such a fabulous place for me, and I have such great memories of it. There's so much that we're going to touch there. We're going to talk great white sharks. We're going to talk snakes. We're going to talk horse racetracks. We're going to talk the Aussie people themselves. I just can't wait to dip into Australia, and we're going to start that on the very next Studcast, and we're going to roll with that. I don't know how long we may be there. I want to do it kind of like we've done this wrestling war. I want to cover it in depth. I when we leave Australia, I want, and we got a lot of fans in Australia, which is really amazing. I get these comments and things, and they're saying, "We can't wait, Ron. We can't wait till you get to Australia." Well, we're coming to Australia, and I think for fans, this is going to be a tremendous ride. It's going to be something they've never heard before. And I love telling Aussie. I'm going to do a little bit of those Aussie accents. I'm going to try to really carry us there and make us feel like we are there in Australia.
It's going to be a long flight to Australia, so rest up, fans, because we'll be there next week. Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week in Australia.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.